This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, a new report questions whether Michigan should steer its economic strategy away from tax cuts and invest in roads, education, the environment, and other areas. But first, gangsters in Southwest Michigan? It's not as shocking as you think. Back in the 1920s, members of the Chicago crime scene treated the area as an oasis, where they dined, played golf, and did their best to keep their business affairs to a minimum. That all changed in 1929 when gangster Frank Killer Burke murdered a South Haven police officer, leading authorities to discover that he had weapons used in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, where seven men from an opposing crime gang were killed in Chicago. Author and historian Chris Lyon explores the events in her new book, A Killing in Capone's Playground. She spoke with WMUK's Aaron Williams about the area's undercover past.
Most people will associate the gangster era and the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and Al Capone and everything that goes with that with Chicago. And that's a pretty much a known thing. We've all been taught that in school. We've seen the movies about it. We watch the TV shows. And the one thing that I was always interested in is what happened, say, on February 15th? What happened after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre? And I was really interested in finding that out. And then being that I'm from this area, it was a little known fact that this area played a huge role in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre aftermath. And very few people really know that. And my goal was to educate people in this history that we have here that has taken us into a whole new level. And if you think about the forensics and the ballistics science that we have today, most of that is based on what happened here in 1929 in St. Joseph, Michigan.
And to take us back to that, there was a murder that took place. Basically, there was a police officer who was killed. Over a minor offense. What was that?
Well, what happened was, and seemed to be somewhat of an unrelated event, was a police officer had tried to stop a motorist who had a car accident and basically left the scene of an accident. And he was trying to get him to stop, to pull over, so they could go over to the police department and settle up the damage. And instead of going right to the police department, the man in the vehicle shot and killed the police officer. And his name was Charles Skelly. He was a 25-year-old male from St. Joseph. And he really had no reason to believe there was anything connected. But once they found the suspect's vehicle, which had crashed down the road a little ways, they ended up finding out where the person lived at, and they ended up going to his house. And the house was located in Stevensville, Michigan. And what they found in the house was something more than what the average person would have, including two Thompson submachine guns, a sawed-off shotgun, several rifles, and dozens of revolvers, and thousands of rounds of ammunition. And they knew at that point there was something to this. And just so happened to be that there was a man named Calvin Goddard who was in Chicago studying the Thompson submachine guns that were used in the massacre. They knew at that point that two Thompson submachine guns had been used in the massacre. They just did not have them. And when they found conveniently two of them in this man's house, they further did some research and they did some fingerprint investigations. And lo and behold, it happens to be a suspect in the massacre named Fred Killer Burke. And he was named as a suspect early on in the investigation in March of 1929. So in December 14th of 1929, was literally 10 months after the massacre, all of this evidence turns up and it tied directly to the massacre and the suspect. And when they actually got the guns in their hands, they were taken to Chicago to be studied. They were determined to be ballistically the actual guns used in the massacre. And this was the most evidence they had ever recovered up until that point and since.
Wow. Obviously, he didn't want to be tracked down because he knew that as soon as that police officer found him, it would lead to all this other stuff.
Exactly. And to think this is just the tip of the iceberg, and this is really what led everyone to know that the gangsters were in this area, and they were living as amongst us as normal citizens. They weren't committing crimes. necessarily. And this really, I think, struck people a little bit differently. And to think that, you know, right amongst us walking on the same streets are the most wanted criminals in the country. And this was the case with Fred Killer Burke. He had been named as a suspect in the massacre. And here he is living in a home in Stevensville that he had purchased in September of 1929. And he's going by the alias name of Fred Dane. And so all the people in the area and businesses and neighbors knew him as Fred Dane, never suspected him of committing a crime, certainly not one like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And so it was a real wake-up call for us. But that story is never told when you learn about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. They always tell you about the Chicago part, but they seem to forget the part, what happened afterward. And that's the part that involves southwestern Michigan. And to me, it's the most important part because it really almost solves the crime, even though it was never officially solved. It was as close as you can get to solving a crime at the point that we have now.
Now, this is not something that you typically hear about in modern day history about Michigan. Why do you feel that it's, I don't want to say it's been forgotten, but why do you feel like it's been overlooked?
You know, and I think because of the nature of it with being a small town police officer, a small town incident, and it just seems to be kind of one of those things that history overlooks often with a lot of things. It's the big cities. We want to associate the big cities with the crimes and the gangsters and bloody Chicago and, you know, the beer wars. But we don't want to admit that maybe there were some other things going on in our small cities. In small towns. This area was very rural. You know, we were farmers. We did a lot of farming industry. There was some bootlegging that was going on, just like it was across the nation. But I think that a lot of it has almost been forgotten because the people in the area almost want to forget about it. It's not something that maybe necessarily the town people were proud of, and they felt a little somewhat betrayed by the gangsters. And that's what I want to do, is I want to get the story out from the people that were here, remember it, and have a direct connection with it. And I've been surprised to have had so many people that have information about it. Either their grandparents were part of it or they had another connection somehow with it. And it's amazing when you can put it all together and fit a big puzzle together and see a whole different side of the story that never was told.
And tell me more about that. How was it finding, because obviously, you know, this happened 9 decades ago. So who were you able to talk with that still had some sort of correlation with these events?
Well, it turns out that a lot of the police officers that were involved in the local aspect of it here in Berrien County and in the state police, they actually have descendants that are still in the area. And in fact, one of them just happens to be my boss, who is a grandson of one of the deputies that took Killer Burke to prison and had actually had several conversations with him. And so it was amazing to be able to hear what it was like behind the scenes almost, because usually you just get the impression of what was going on from the newspapers. And that was the main form of information back then. But here you get a different view. You get somebody that was behind the scenes and had a different impression, and maybe some of the more details that were never revealed during the normal press conference that they had. And I think it made the characters come to life a little bit more, and you actually saw a softer side of them. You know, sad to say that you don't want to think of a gangster as being a good guy, but there was some human factors involved where they did come out, and they were somewhat compassionate in some form.
How long did it take you to do all the research and to finally put this book together?
The whole writing process was about 5 years. And I think during that time, it was probably maybe a couple years before that I actually started research. But what I found was I couldn't just write it from an outline, an established outline, because as soon as I began doing that, and I would find out more information that would take the story in a different direction. And so I almost had to research it and write it almost at the same time. And again, some of the things that I found out weren't very typical. you know, being that I work in the public safety industry, of course, I want our police officers to be our heroes. And in some cases, I found that some of the police officers weren't the heroes, and sometimes they were the bad guys. And some of the gangsters, who obviously you want them to be the bad guys, they're actually kind of good in a way. And so something like that, it may be hard to write and hard to accept, but it's what happened, and it's what people said happened. And that's what I want to get out, is, you know, the real story of what happened after that.
What is it that made you decide that, you know what, I want to go and, like, what made you really want to, like, dig in and say, I want to write a book about this?
I think it was just something that stirred me because of previous attempts to tell this part of the story were very maybe shallow attempts where they didn't really get into the story. They basically gave a skimmed over version and essentially basically a rehashing of the newspaper article. And I knew there was a lot more to it. And when I really started to decide I wanted to do this, I actually sent out a FOIA request to the state of Michigan, and I received probably about 300 pages worth of memos, police reports, witness statements, testimony, coroner's information, and so much information that it was obvious that there was going to have to be a book written about it. And I knew I had enough information, and I wanted to tell the story, the full story, not just the last day of Charles Kelly's life, but his life in general and what led up to it, what happened afterward, and what we've learned from it since.
I feel like this is one of those events that it happens, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this is unfortunate. This man died, mm-hmm. but I don't think that he realized that his death was not going to be in vain. Obviously, he didn't realize that, but you know, do you get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and that's the beauty. That's really the beauty of it all, because I think that deep down, he knew he was going to die. He said that he knew he'd been shot and he knew he was fading away. I don't think he realized what the extent was and what was going to come from his death, but it is absolutely, if there's anyone who's a hero, it would be Charles Skelly, because he was 25 years old. He died at that same night, 3 hours later after he was shot, 1929. And it was after that is when ballistics and forensics essentially became mainstream, and they were finally accepted into the mainstream American society. And really, if it weren't for him, he was the one that provided the avenue, that opened the door to that evidence. Without him being shot and killed, that evidence would have remained hidden. It may have been essentially gone at some point. Maybe the suspect would have taken off with it, and we'd be so far behind where we are now. And it's amazing to think that this one guy, this 25-year-old police officer, had that power to do that.
Did anything surprise you about Fred Burke when you were researching him? I mean, obviously, you know, he was a criminal who had this checkered past, but did anything stand out to you in this man's life or his history or anything?
Yeah, with Fred Killer Burke, he started out as a petty criminal into forgeries and theft and bad checks. And then he kind of graduated into something much more, into a hitman, machine gunner. And surprisingly, he learned how to shoot a machine gun while he was in World War I. He was actually sent over to France. He served in the army, and he learned how to shoot a machine gun there. And so that was kind of a surprising fact that, you know, he's considered a veteran. He learned how to shoot a machine gun, and instead of using that in a positive way, he came back and used it, obviously, in a negative way. And the one thing that I learned also is that Fred Burke never admitted to any crimes at all. He never said he committed anyone except where he killed Charles Skelly. That was the only crime that he ever admitted to doing. And he actually felt bad about it. And while he was being taken up to prison in Marquette, on the way up there, he said, "I'm sorry that I killed that boy." And I think that was about the softest and most compassionate thing he could have said. And coming from a killer of his stature, it's pretty amazing that he was able to admit that, and he did. But that's the only crime he ever admitted to. He would never say anything about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre or any of the other alleged crimes he was involved with, but he did at least fess up to this one.
So with that being said, what do you want audiences to take away from reading this book? What do you think they'll be most surprised by when they read it?
I think that mostly people will probably be surprised at, again, how the gangsters weren't necessarily so much bad guys when they were around here and how actually accepted they were. You know, because you think about it, this is during the right towards the end of the Roaring Twenties. The Depression has just started to set in. And when these guys would come into town, everybody knew it. And when they would come into town in their big black sedans, it was almost payday for so many businesses and so many people in industries in the Benton Harbor and St. Joseph area. And when he came into town, he spent money. And the businesses that he spent a lot of money at, restaurants, golf courses, and hotels, they were paid very generously with tips. And it's kind of hard to deny when you get a $500 tip, you know, from a gangster, and you don't even make that in a year, but you get that as a tip. And I think people appreciated that. It was obviously something they needed at that time. And while they were here, they were very courteous. They were gentlemen, from what many witnesses have described them as, and they were very respectful. And it's hard to put those words together with a name like Al Capone, because we know so much more about him on the other side. But surprisingly, when they were here, which is why I call the book Capone's Playground, this was their playground. They were on vacation. They were not doing their business. And they pretty much kept to that. So there was no crimes being committed necessarily. And they were very peaceful people. Up until the moment that Charles Skelly was killed in 1929, that's when it all changed. And that was really a pivotal moment, because at that point, the community in the area finally said that you're no longer welcome in our area. And that really was the kicker.
Author and historian Chris Lyon is the author of A Killing in Capone's Playground. She spoke with WMUK's Aaron Williams. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A new report says Michigan must make a greater investment in areas such as education, infrastructure, arts, and the environment. The interactive report and video, Michigan Dream at Risk, was produced by the Michigan Economic Center. CEO John Austin says it was inspired by one of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation's Pure Michigan videos.
Wasn't it Tim Allen and his voiceover? It was images, some words scrolling across, violins playing. And it was, you know, kids running out of the cottage and jumping in the lake. They featured the number one public university in North America, which is University of Michigan. They were featuring the open road, people driving across Michigan. And people marveling at the arts and culture, you know, the DIA, and looking in wonder at the Henry Ford kids there. And you want to stop it periodically and say, look, that number one public university, we've cut it, and the tuitions have doubled, and we've priced it out of reach for most families. Watch out on that open road. It's going to be full of potholes. That lake could have fecal matter. Beach closures have doubled in the last 10 years because we basically haven't been investing in cleanup. So the Pure Michigan that is so powerful, which is in those images that we love, is not as real as it needs to be.
John Austin is also the president of the Michigan Board of Education. Let me begin by asking you to define the Michigan Dream. What are the similarities and maybe some differences from the American Dream?
It's really the people of Michigan who gave us this picture, which I think those of us who grew up in Michigan, or I married into Michigan and been raising our family and working here for 20-some years. We did these wonderful focus groups and followed up with some survey work around the state last year. And part of the questions that we asked are, you know, what is unique about Michigan? What does Michigan mean to you? We even had people select from images the image of that ideal Michigan that represents that kind of ideal. And people, wherever they were, whether Detroit or up in Traverse City or out in western Michigan, all both named the same special attributes and even picked the same images. And One, it was a beautiful outdoors. I mean, the Great Lakes and enjoying that with your family, and pictures of enjoying pure Michigan leap to the front of mind. People everywhere are proud of our great schools and universities, and these kind of public universities, whether it's Western or University of Michigan or Michigan State, these great institutions. You know, people very very committed and feel that's a very important part of the Michigan story of opportunity, is to have these great both public schools but great higher education institutions as a path to a better life, where hard work, when you talk to Michiganders, we're hard workers and we think hard work should be rewarded, and part of that is the chance to get a better life. If you work hard in school, you can have a better life for your kids. And then the iconic products that we make, you know, autos and maybe some new things, maybe some green infrastructure or windmills or new science that can create new jobs. The hard work created new products and opportunity, and great communities that are really nice places to raise a family. This is a family state, and people want to have communities, and certainly the Michigan dream includes communities you can be proud of to raise a family, that have good roads, that are attractive places, and that your kids want to stay in, that your kids want to stay and raise their families too and stay nearby. So we're a family state, we're a hardworking state, we are committed to education, and we enjoy our outdoors and the open road. And that's kind of the Michigan dream as the pathway to opportunity. Great schools, great infrastructure, great hardworking people who create new ideas and new products. And you know, that's a picture of the beautiful outdoors that is so vivid right now as I'm looking out my window here in Ann Arbor, and I'm sure you're having a nice day out in Kalamazoo.
Well, we are, but I'm in a windowless room at the moment. But well, but when you take that survey and focus groups and you get that feedback from people, did you also gauge them for, are they willing to pay more to sustain these things or make them better than they are now?
Well, we also asked them, how are we doing at supporting these things, or what's the condition of these assets, our outdoors, our education institutions, our roads and our infrastructure, our communities? And they said very clearly that these things they value very much, that they think drive Michigan and really make it go as a unique and wonderful state and make it go economically, are degraded and diminished. We had a survey question that said, you know, 50%, over 50% of people thought that the basic services, you know, fire, water, roads, the condition of the parks and the community infrastructure, education had all been diminished over the last dozen years. And certainly in the report, you know, there's lots of facts and figures in the report, and I encourage people to go to the michigandream.org and just see the report and the video. It's not the facts and figures that really tell the story. It's what citizens of Michigan, many featured in the video and in the report, say matters, and they're not happy about the diminished condition of, you know, our roads. Our parks aren't being maintained. Our higher education institutions like Western, all of them have doubled in their tuitions over the last 10 years because we've cut state support in real dollars 30% over the last 10 years. That's why tuitions are twice as high. Our great, almost free, high-quality higher education institutions are being priced out of reach of working people, and Michigan's people are not happy about that.
So if Michigan is going to invest in things like high-quality roads and more funding for state universities so they don't need to raise tuition as much and to protect the environment and all the things that you've mentioned, does that mean that Michigan citizens are going to have to pay more in taxes?
Yes, but here's the dirty little secret of what we've been doing as a state, I guess supporting our political leaders in doing it. We have basically been on a path of 12 or 13 years of reducing our tax rates, reducing taxes, basically the level of effort of what we, whatever incomes we have, and we've been through a rough patch with the Great Recession and the auto industry collapse, but the share of our income that we put into roads and higher education and our parks and our clean water and these public investments that we have to make together because they don't happen any other way, the share of income of our personal income in Michigan has dropped from 4% to 3% over the last 12 years. If we had the same corporate business tax rates, we've cut corporate business taxes dramatically. We're now like at the lowest level of any state in terms of our corporate business taxes. And we've been reducing the personal flat income tax for 12 or 13 years, basically. If we went back to the same tax rates, just the rates we had under Governor John Engler, Republican, we'd have $8 billion. We we've basically taken $8 billion out of our willingness to pay for schools that would fix every pothole, that would make higher education affordable if we just had the same level of effort in taxation. We used to be bumping up against this Headley cap. You know, there was a state initiative that capped the amount of our income that could be basically spent on state and local taxes. We used to be bumping up against that. That's not true anymore. We're $8 billion below that Headley limit. We've got some room for and some need, clearly. I mean, everybody agrees we got to spend some more money to fix the roads. Our leaders cannot find the political spine to do it, to pull the trigger. And I think on education and on roads, Michigan's people are willing to support them. They want to pay money for great schools, not schools that are have giant class sizes and diminished arts and music and extracurriculars. And they want to pay to fix the roads. And when we ask citizens about why the roads matter to the economy and their communities, yes, it costs you money if you bang your tire in a pothole. But the main reason people are upset about the roads is they're embarrassed. People, our communities are falling apart. And people want to live in communities that they're proud of and raise a family. Who'd want to raise a family or have a business in a community that you can't keep the lights on or that the roads are a mess or that you've cut basically the life out of the public services? This is what and why would anyone stay? Why would our kids stay in Michigan if it's in that condition? So this is the way people talked about it, and they talk in the video and in this interactive report telling us in those more personal ways why we need to do things that can rebuild the Michigan that is this Michigan dream.
Now, you say that the people support these ideas, and yet the politicians don't seem to have the political will to enact them. So how do you make that transition?
Then that's what we're encouraging people to help our leaders do, is sign up at the website, and we'll share your contact. And you know, if you want to help rebuild the Michigan dream, share it with advocacy organizations that are working on arts and culture, they're working on higher ed, that are working to help our political leaders have some more understanding that we care about these things. And I think people will support things they're emotionally connected to, and we have to get it away from a facts and figure argument to know this is about the Michigan dream, the Michigan that we love, and we want to have it rebuilt, not torn down. And that's got to be the message. But also, we have to reverse this theology. You know, it's kind of a religion that has dominated the political landscape, that if you cut taxes in the name of business friendliness, and you know, basically reduce all these public investments that we make, that somehow will magically grow jobs in the economy. And that's just not true. And if anything, it disables the economy because you don't have good services, you don't have communities that people want to live in or businesses and entrepreneurs would want to locate in. You don't have well-educated people or a community. In Kalamazoo is a wonderful leader and exception. You yourselves said, we're going to be the community that organizes around being the best educated and higher education attainment and drive economic development by through the Kalamazoo Promise. That's the way, and that's an investment. It's private dollars, but it's matched by a lot of public dollars and effort. But that's the kind of investment that pays off, that creates a climate where people want to live, work, grow a business, and you're reanimating people living in the city of Kalamazoo with that kind of investment in education. And that's how the economy works. You know, people want to live, work, be in places that have attributes that make them exciting, wonderful places to be, that include great schools, great opportunity for higher education, good services, nice quality of life, great place to raise a family, great place to run a business. It's hard to run a business when you don't have, you know, the basic infrastructure around to play in the economy, whether it's good roads or good other transportation options or good communications. All of those are things that we need to invest in together.
John Austin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
John Austin is director of the Michigan Economic Center. He's also the president of the Michigan State Board of Education. Longer versions of interviews and links with more information can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.